Over the last 6 months, I've interviewed a variety of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. In this edition, we introduce you to three leaders who are changing the way government does business. NASA continues to face significant operational changes, from retiring the shuttle program to transitioning to the next generation space transportation system for exploring beyond low Earth orbit to the exploration of Mars. In seizing these opportunities and meeting such challenges, NASA continues its role as a nation's pioneer in space exploration, scientific discovery, and aeronautics research. And its future is quite bright, according to NASA's Chief Human Capital Officer, Jerry Buchholz.
So NASA was created in October of 1958, and I think people are very familiar with the NASA history. It's part of our U.S. cultural history through the Gemini program, the Apollo program, and the Space Shuttle program. And as your listeners probably know, the Space Shuttle program ended about a year and a half ago. And at that time, people were sort of wondering if there was really a future for NASA. So one of the things that I'm pleased to say today is that indeed the future for NASA is quite bright. We are currently working on the James Webb Telescope, which is a very, very long-range telescope that's being built. We are also working on the new Orion vehicle, which will take astronauts past the moon, and the SLS rocket to launch that. And I think of great interest always is the fact that we have astronauts living and working on the space station 365 days a year.
As NASA's CHECO, Buchholz plays a significant role in keeping the agency's future bright, making sure it has the right people with the right skills in the right roles in order to meet its current and future missions.
I have a really interesting and unique role. So I'm, of course, responsible for overall agency policy, for the overarching executive resources of the agency, and for the IT infrastructure that the human resources business operation runs on. But my most important contribution to the agency mission is the work that I do on workforce culture and ensuring that NASA has the workforce culture, the innovative culture it needs, so that in, you know, at some point in the future, human beings can travel beyond the moon to Mars, and also so that we can engage in our Earth observation activities related to climate and weather, et cetera. It is interesting because culture and working on culture issues is very, very different than HR business operations. And it can be challenging sometimes to keep that sorted out and to really be sure always that the things that you are working on really do address the issue that you're trying to address. But I have to also say that the culture work is, for me at least, by far the more exciting, innovative, creative aspect of the job.
In forging an innovative workforce culture, Buchholz is focusing on three areas.
What we're focusing on to create that environment of innovation, we really focus in three areas. We focus on connecting our people to each other and the mission, which is challenging in times when travel, training, and conferences are receiving a great deal of scrutiny across the federal government. We focus on building what we call model supervisors, those supervisors that display the attributes that we need to lead NASA into the future. And we focus on recognizing and rewarding innovative performance. So as we work on developing our strategy, as we work on implementing our strategy, which we're doing at the same time, we really try to focus our efforts in those three areas.
NASA must be doing something right. It was rated the best place to work among large federal government agencies by the Partnership for Public Service, based on results from its annual survey of government employees.
And I have to say that I am just so very, very proud of the NASA workforce. That was not an easy transition for people to make. It was not an easy transition for the agency itself to make or for the agency's culture to make. But we knew we had succeeded when we were ranked the best large agency in the federal government by the Partnership for Public Service, largely based on our scores that our employees gave us on employee engagement. So we were going through a major transformation of our agency mission, end of a 30-year program, you know, going forward in a completely new and different direction. Many people wrote us off. Many people expected our results to tank. And in fact, that wouldn't be an unreasonable outcome to expect under such difficult circumstances. First, we made sure that we told people that their opinion matters. that we want to know what they think because we want to work to make the organization the best organization that we can make it, given our circumstances, certainly. The second thing that we did is what I call connecting the dots. The other thing is the mistake that I see other agencies make is they focus on 12 things. So nothing gets the direct attention that it needs. My best advice is focus on one or two things that really matter to your workforce. Tell them that their opinion matters and connect the dots back to the feedback that you've received.
The Obama administration's recently proposed budget calls for more investment in the nation's public buildings. These investments, according to the administration, will enable GSA's public buildings service to properly maintain and improve the real estate assets owned and paid for by the American people. Dorothy Robine, commissioner of PBS, explains its mission.
The Public Building Service is the real estate arm of the federal government. People refer to us as the landlord to the civilian agencies. I don't usually use the L word, though. We have a total of 375 million square feet of space, and it's roughly half federally owned space and half leased space, actually. It's a little bit more leased than owned, a total of about 9,600 buildings, and they're distributed throughout the country and territories of the United States. We are very much of a regional organization. There are 11 regions, and they correspond pretty much to the divisions of the courts or other federal agencies. The largest is the National Capital Region. About a quarter of all of our space is in the National Capital Region, not surprisingly. That's where a lot of federal buildings are. And then 10 other regions, and the regions report up through the central office, my office. And then I report to Dan Tangerlini, the head of GSA.
As PBS commissioner, Robine oversees the work performed by these offices, as well as directs resources, manages stakeholder expectation, and most of all, sets strategic direction for the office. Though the job is challenging under normal circumstances, Robine took the helm in the aftermath of congressional investigations about mismanagement and has worked with acting GSA administrator Dan Tangerlini to address many of the issues facing PBS. In tackling these pressing issues, challenges remain.
The two overarching challenges are the budget and the organizational structure of PBS. The budget is a huge challenge because the last 3 years, we have not gotten access to all of the money coming into the federal building fund. In fact, we have not gotten access to about $1 billion to $1.5 billion each year. So that's a significant amount. The amount of money going into the federal building fund is money that I feel I should be reinvesting in buildings. I charge commercial rates to our federal customers for those buildings, and I feel that I owe it to them and to taxpayers to be putting that money back into our buildings. The last couple of years, $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year has been diverted from the federal building fund into other activities. So Dan Tangerlini's and my biggest challenge is to try to get PBS back on a solid budget footing, meaning getting access to all of the funds coming into the federal building fund to support our activities. We have a huge backlog of unmet repair and maintenance needs, including fire life safety issues, because we have not gotten access to that funding. So getting us back on a solid budget footing is absolutely critical to the future of PBS. I don't see how the organization can continue to function effectively if we don't get back on a solid budget footing.
The second overarching challenge facing Robine is the organizational structure of PBS. For her, it's all about arranging the organization the best way in order to make it successful.
What PBS does is inherently very local in nature. We build, maintain, operate buildings. Buildings are very, very local. So the work that we do is inherently very, very local. But not everything that we do needs to be done in 11 places. And that is the way that that we're currently organized. But I think now we're dealing with perhaps an excess of regional autonomy. I think that may have contributed to the problems of a year ago that brought Dan and me into the organization.
There's a strong culture in GSA for promoting property disposal. The biggest impediments, Robine points out, are the upfront cost of getting rid of property, various legal requirements, and stakeholder interest. The administration has proposed the creation of a civilian equivalent to the Defense Base Closure and Realignment, or BRAC, process. The beauty of the BRAC process, according to Robine, is that there is an independent commission that looks at a variety of alternatives and identifies the best options. Congress then can vote up or down on these options. They cannot cherry-pick. It's all or nothing. In the end, moving PBS forward is Robine's ultimate mission.
I think GSA generally, but PBS has a particularly important role to play in the coming years because agencies are looking to reduce their budgets, and space is an area, just like in the private sector, where they can do that, and we can help them do that.
Brian Sivak, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, completes our profiles by detailing his efforts to advance collaboration and innovation within his department. HHS sits atop a vast array of data, information, and expertise that, if leveraged and properly applied innovatively, could transform health and healthcare delivery within this country. With advances in technology and the development of various collaborative platforms, we are witnessing a prime opportunity to make a vision of the future a reality today.
One of the interesting things about my job in particular is that I actually have two titles. One title is Chief Technology Officer. The other title is Entrepreneur in Residence. And in many ways, I actually think the EIR side of my title is a little more descriptive of what I actually do. One thing I've learned over time, and I say this as a technologist and as a big geek, right, and somebody who loves technology and thinks that, you know, usually jumps to a technology solution is the first one because it's just how my brain works. But one of the things I've learned over time is that technology is rarely a solution to a problem. Technology can be an enabler. It can be a catalyst. It can be an accelerant. But it often needs to be sort of layered on top of some more fundamental change, which would be usually culture change or process change.
Since becoming CTO, Sivak has sought to change both culture and processes in an institution of almost 80,000 staff and a budget well into the hundreds of billions. No small feat, but given that Sivak is only the second CTO in HHS history, it further underscores the ambitiousness of his vision.
And so that's where I think the EIR side of my job comes in. And a lot of what we're focusing on right now is how to actually affect cultural change within the department so that we can put technology on top of it and actually make things better.
The key for Brian Sivak is experimenting. That is, finding things that work even if they are slightly outside the box. But this motivation goes beyond data.
How do we recognize the value in people? This is tricky. Because what this really means is culture change. And culture change is probably the hardest thing that you'll ever attempt to do. It's easy to, throw a piece of technology on top of something and hope that it works. It's much, much harder to get people to change. Change is hard. So what we're doing is really approaching this from a somewhat systematic perspective, building a framework of a series of programs that will hopefully get us to this sort of overarching goal.
Sivak has crafted a series of programs to facilitate culture change across HHS. Fostering collaboration is critical to it all. In the history of disruptive innovation, there are very few eureka moments, he admits. What tends to happen is really a culmination of years of people collectively collaborating on a problem. Sivak is fond of using a term coined by Tony Hsieh, Zappos CEO, called serendipitous collision. Enabling serendipitous collision involves changing the physical workspaces at HHS, as well as architecting virtual collaboration platforms.
One of the things that we're looking at doing is creating actually a physical space called HHS Labs, which think about it like a Silicon Valley style co-working space where, all of the furniture is modular, there are no walls, every surface is writable. And I'm not talking about building some crazy expensive thing out here. I'm talking about, going to IKEA and buying some cheap furniture on wheels that you can push around and it doesn't matter if it gets dinged up, right? We're not talking about building something fancy. We're talking about building something with low barrier to connection. So that's one side of it. Then the other side is what I'll call a virtual collaboration space. So about 6 months ago, we launched a internal collaboration network across the department. We had the secretary announce it to sort of give her validation that this is something that we wanted to do. We've been working to increase adoption and engagement on this. Again, this is, it's hard. It's culture change. But we've seen some pretty remarkable stuff start to happen. People asking questions that would not have normally asked questions, or people at various levels in the department interacting that never would have interacted before. And so these are great things.
Brian Sivak also wants to identify early adopters within the department. To do this, he has launched two programs, HHS Ignite and HHS Fair Trade.
So what we're looking at trying to do is trying to help connect people who have ideas but need resources to implement those ideas, not necessarily money, but mainly people and skills.
This desire goes beyond the borders of the department. CVAC's looking to attract entrepreneurial talent from the outside, which has two benefits.
We have essentially some hand-selected high-risk, high-reward projects that exist across the department. And when I say hand-select, I mean the secretary will select the things that she thinks are important. And what we then do is bring external people in for a period of a year, no more, no less, to actually work on solving these problems. And that has two benefits. One, we get new ideas into the mix that we probably wouldn't have otherwise. Number two, you have some people that are not necessarily bound by some of the bureaucratic handcuffs that folks on the inside are, and are able to prove that there are better ways of doing things. And so this is sort of a, injecting new concepts into the mix.
HHS has sponsored challenge competitions as part of the America Competes Act as another way to inject external ideas and dynamism into the department. Bringing in new ideas and new people can go a long way towards changing an institution's culture, but the support of risk-taking and experimentation can directly affect the behavior of your staff.
We believe that if we can, implement these programs and then track, their progress, we will be able to start to affect this idea of culture change across the department.
Next up, perspectives on ending veteran homelessness when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns.